Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. No one reported in custody or any suspected gunman or gunmen identified after at least four people were killed, more than 20 others injured, in a mass shooting at a bar near Hilton Head, South Carolina, late last night. In Chicago, many were running through the streets because it was the annual Chicago Marathon. Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda and Ethiopian Howie Faiza won the men's and women's races. Illinois Governor Pritzker should suffer some consequences as Vice President Vance, alleging the governor hasn't protected Illinois citizens. Pritzker says, come and get me. President Trump travels soon to the Mideast, scheduled at what the White House is calling a peace summit in Egypt with leaders of more than 20 countries. From Prime Minister Netanyahu's office, a big day tomorrow.
The release of our hostages will begin early Monday morning. We are expecting all 20 of our living hostages to be released together at one time to the Red Cross.
This is ABC News. A dangerous investigation underway at the volatile site of the huge blast at an explosives factory in Bucksnort, Tennessee, Friday. 16 people, everyone inside, were killed. There's virtually nothing left of the building. Near the scene, ABC's Molalenghi.
To identify victims, authorities have had to rely on rapid DNA technology. They've had to try to figure out whose belongings were found at the site, as well as looking into cell phone data, whose cell phones were at the site at the time of the blast.
More tributes and praise for Diane Keaton at the sudden news yesterday of her death. Keaton won an Oscar for the lead role in Woody Allen's Annie Hall. She was also in the Godfather movies and many others. Here she is with Jack Nicholson in Something's Gotta Give.
Okay. Pancakes, pasta, leftover coq au vin, grilled cheese?
Pancakes.
Oh, totally what I wanted.
Diane Keaton was 79. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Dr. Kristen Lierley.
At what point are we as a society going to stand up and say, hey, wait a minute, something's wrong here? This is just the latest attack on women, on trying to control our bodies. They want women to have more babies. They don't want us to have birth control. They don't want us to get abortions. They don't want us to take medications. They want us to be in pain. They don't want us to have hospitals to be able to go to. They're defunding all of our rural hospitals.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Farm news that impacts you and your community from the Midwest Farm Report throughout your day on 107.5 WLAK.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shali Pittman. Policy experts are urging Congress to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits. They're warning that premiums could more than double if there's no action taken. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Public News Service has more.
Policy experts are calling on Congress to not only extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits, but to address the broader issue of rapidly rising health care costs that threaten to crush hundreds of thousands of Wisconsinites. Angela Hanks with the nonprofit Century Foundation says many are now faced with a worsening health care affordability crisis caused by deliberate policy choices in Congress. Legislation passed over the summer would result in up to 15 million people losing Medicaid or health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, with enhanced ACA tax credits set to expire at the end of the year.
We've put that as an average enrollee paying over $1,000 more next year for their health care if Congress takes no action this year.
An analysis from the foundation shows rural counties will be disproportionately affected, with enrollees potentially facing a 28% higher cost increase than those in urban areas. Wisconsin saw a record 18% jump in ACA marketplace enrollment this year. year, with more than 313,000 people purchasing a plan. Insurance companies have already reported their rates for the next year, projecting an average 18% increase in premiums for ACA plans across the board. That's the largest increase in more than 5 years. This means ACA enrollees face both rising premiums and the potential loss of tax credits that help make insurance affordable. Hank stresses that healthcare affordability is not a partisan issue, noting that more than 3/4 of Americans want to see the tax credits continue, including 2/3 of Republicans. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
More news anytime at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to 107.5 WLAK, Amory's home for mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy and breezy with isolated showers possible today and a high near 70. Mostly cloudy, still breezy tonight, occasional showers around and a low in the low 50s. Sunshine returns for Monday, highs in the low 60s. Right now it's 61.
Jane Mattenair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, what is the view from across the pond for Democrats who live overseas? We're going to hear from George King IV from Democrats Abroad. Join us.
Mattenair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Mattenair on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. I thank you for joining me this weekend when once again in the areas of law and justice and the delivery and administration of the rule of law throughout our nation, including right here in Wisconsin, we have an awful lot to talk about. It has indeed been a very busy week in the area of rule of law for the past several days. We're going to get to many of those stories. As always, my producer and I, Max, are welcoming you to be a part of our discussion by calling in at that number, which is 855-752-4842. Once again, Max and I will take your phone calls, your inquiries, your questions, your puzzlements, your curiosities about those matters that are on our achievable but ambitious syllabus this weekend. That number, 855-752-4842. Let me tell you a little bit about what is on that academic agenda for this weekend's production and our broadcast. We're going to begin, of course, with some of the major news following up on our discussion last week about authoritarianism, as signaled by the indictment of the previous days of former FBI Director James Comey. We're going to continue that discussion by telling you about what happened at the arraignment of James Comey in Eastern Virginia just this past week. That, of course, is that hearing, that initial appearance, at which time the defendant enters a plea. Not surprisingly, James Comey pled not guilty to the two counts in the indictment against him. We'll tell you more about that. And arguably, even more significantly, we're going to tell you about other discussions had during the course of this 30-minute initial appearance, this 30-minute arraignment in front of the federal district court judge. Told us a lot about what the defense is going to do, very much consistent with what we talked about in our broadcast last week and the likely defenses to this indictment, both on substance, but more importantly, even on process and the reasons why it is here, alleging vindictive prosecution, selective prosecution, also a challenge likely to the very status, the capacity of that interim United States attorney to bring this case in the first place, based upon a challenge to her authorization that also discussed, and then the judge also entertained with the parties that included, of course, defense counsel and counsel for the government, for the U.S. Department of Justice prosecuting this case, entertained argument and entertained discussion with them about the timing of what's going to happen next. The trial date, when that will happen, and what are the circumstances under which that will go forward in connection with these pretrial motions challenging that indictment itself. We'll tell you all about James Comey's appearance this past week in that federal district court. Again, no substantive disposition, but an awful lot of revelation about what we're going to be seeing in the coming weeks and months in connection with the defense of that major federal criminal prosecution. You know as well that that prosecution was joined by yet another this past week. That's right. Out of the same district, again, out of the Eastern District of Virginia. Another indictment, this one charging Letitia James with bank fraud. Not so much the mortgage fraud, but the bank fraud allegations against her. We'll tell you all about what a federal grand jury said once again at the encouragement, the presentation of this interim United States attorney. We'll tell you exactly what is and is not, curiously, in that new indictment against Letitia James. She, of course, the Attorney General of the state of New York, who has sparred with Donald Trump, and that is understating it dramatically, and got that several hundred million dollar judgment against him for fraud. That judgment, of course, overturned in part with respect to the amount of money, but the judgment itself, finding that Donald Trump in New York had indeed violated, at least civilly, the laws of New York. That stays in place. She has also plainly gone after him and various institutions, revealing the fraud and the deception of other entities, other initiatives of him over time. And that, of course, has drawn the ire of the president, both before, during, and after his first term, and certainly during this term as well. We have talked a lot about the premises, the predicates, the encouragement of this president to bring to the halls of justice, to bring into the courtrooms those people who have been adversaries of his, including James Comey, the former FBI director, including Letitia James, the still current Attorney General of the state of New York, and many others on that list. Those have included recently, of course, California Senator Adam Schiff. Also allegations out there that he also engaged in mortgage fraud. Nothing proven there, nothing charged there yet. President talking about why he thinks Adam Schiff should also be indicted. He has also talked about others on that list, including people like Fannie Willis, the former prosecutor of that case in Fulton County. Talked recently about Christopher Wray, the former director of the FBI, also in the wake of James Comey's service as director of the FBI, no longer there. Chris Wray appointed by Donald Trump, but running afoul of him, apparently, at least from perspective of the president, and has also talked about George Soros, many other people in the view of the president who have been his adversaries, his opponents, and overtly in public statements, celebrating the indictment of James Comey, indicating to his Attorney General Pam Bondi that she should pursue that case and others as well in the interests of justice, celebrating the return of grand jury indictments and indicating that plainly the White House is now directing exactly what it is that the Department of Justice, through the U.S. Attorney's offices, now principally in Eastern Virginia, should be doing. And in that connection, yet more reporting just this past week, no charges yet, but another one of the president's recent adversaries, his name, John Bolton. You recall well, he was the former national security advisor in Donald Trump's first term in the office of the presidency. And John Bolton, as you may recall as well, at his home in Maryland, again, just outside of the nation's capital there in Washington, D.C., the subject, the target of a search. Remember that? Early morning search, reviewing and taking from that location a number of documents and the allegation reported on. We don't know because there have been no charges specifically, as it had to do something with classified documents and the retention, maybe the use, we're not sure at all, by John Bolton of those documents, plainly reminiscent of the charges brought against this president himself for taking documents from the White House to his location in Mar-a-Lago, classified other national security documents. The suggestion is that that search warrant was predicated upon a finding of probable cause by a magistrate judge that maybe, just maybe, John Bolton had in that location some documents he should not have and is therefore committing a crime under federal law. Interestingly, we'll talk more about that and the predicates for that and the reasons why that John Bolton prospective, possible future prosecution. Some reporting indicating that it may be forthcoming as soon as this coming week. That is formal charges coming out of a Maryland grand jury. Why that also is significant in its difference between it and the charges against James Comey and Letitia James, and why even in its investigation and possible prosecution, it underscores this concept of authoritarianism and the reasons why you do not want a president, you do not want an attorney general, you do not want anybody in official capacity talking about political enemies and identifying them as possible targets of prosecution. The teaser on that is just this. When you do that, you basically undermine the legitimate prosecutions that you may have out there, including legitimate prosecutions that may just happen to be against your political rivals and adversaries out there. We'll get more into that as we talk again about authoritarianism in America, as evidenced by the recent prosecution, the arraignment of James Comey, the indictment of Letitia James, the charges there, the responses that she has made to that indictment alleging bank fraud, and the prospective prosecution of John Bolton. What all of that means as we continue to talk about authoritarianism here on Amicus Law Review. We necessarily, based upon the news of this past week, also need to talk about the National Guard deployments or not. The litigation challenges in places like Portland, Oregon, Chicago, Illinois. We'll talk about what district court judges in those two venues have done, what the appeals courts have done as well. And we're necessarily going to be doing some summarization, some summaries of what also has been going on in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., and yes, indeed, now another city, Memphis, Tennessee. We'll talk about the litigation in those cases, including the litigation in district courts and appellate courts. And finally, as a part of our second hour here on Amicus, of course, we return to the United States Supreme Court. Had a major, major series of oral arguments just this past week. Six of them all together. We talked about those last week on the broadcast. Going to highlight, make some predictions here about what the Supreme Court will likely do in two of those cases. One of them involving the legitimacy of a Colorado ban on conversion therapy, allegations that that ban prohibits the free exercise of religion and free speech. We'll tell you about what the Supreme Court seemed to be indicating when it comes to its response to that attack on the ban on conversion therapy in Colorado. And then there's also this other major case among the six argued just last week, having to do with absentee ballot voting and the counting of those votes coming out of Illinois, just to the south of us here in Wisconsin, and whether or not election officials can continue to count votes and ballots and review them and make them a part of the process, even if they're not all counted on Election Day itself. In Illinois, a law that says you can continue to count 14 days after the election for those ballots that have, in fact, been mailed, submitted prior to or on Election Day itself. An interesting voting case coming up again for decision, like the conversion therapy case, probably in June of this year. But interesting oral arguments. We'll tell you about how the justices seem to be reacting to those two cases. And then we're going to talk about what's going to happen this coming week. Four more cases after the federal holiday on Monday. Four more cases on Tuesday and Wednesday involving habeas corpus and criminal restitution and searches of homes. And yes, indeed, what may be the most important case on the docket of the Supreme Court this term, coming up on Wednesday for oral argument, case called Louisiana versus Calais, arguably presenting the Supreme Court with an opportunity to review the very legitimacy, the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act itself. Section 2 will tell you all about what Louisiana Calais means for the court, and we'll entertain prospects of what the Supreme Court could do in that oral argument and beyond of this coming week. All of that, an ambitious but achievable agenda here on Amicus Law Review. Again, inviting your participation through your comments, your questions, your inquiries, your curiosities about all this, because yes, indeed, as always, we take a deep breath and say, It's a lot. And that's our purpose here on Amicus Law Review. And so we encourage you to call in with those questions at 855-752-4842. Max is here as well, taking those phone calls, making you a part of our conversation about all of these things, big, small, and in between, that animate the rule of law in America, that make it clear that we need to understand what's going on in our nation to not only formulate our own views, but to make certain that our future is full of representation of all of us. All that coming up here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. The Trump administration confirmed in September it is sharing driver's license and Social Security information among federal and state agencies from a massive database of personal and voter data. A class action lawsuit by voters and pro-voter groups has been filed to stop it. Since May, 38 states have received requests to turn over voter registration and voting records, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. As of October 1st, the only state to have complied is Indiana. Eight states which refused to comply have now been sued by the Trump Department of Justice. The administration reportedly repurposed an existing U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services database for verifying immigration status called Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements, or the SAVE system. NPR reported in September that the immigration status of 33 million voters had been checked using the database. The new lawsuit contends, quote, Congress passed the Privacy Act of 1974 specifically to prevent the government from creating formal or de facto national databanks or centralized federal information systems that would consolidate sensitive personal information of Americans stored at separate agencies, unquote. The voters and groups are asking the court for an injunction prohibiting the administration from using personal data not allowed by the Privacy Act. We've linked the complaint from AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Seems like nobody in America agrees on much of anything these days.
But can we agree the federal government shouldn't tax people into poverty?
If you work full-time, you should be able to afford your basic needs, don't you think? We're the Patriotic Millionaires.
We believe your full-time job should cover what it costs to live. We think your first $45,000 of income should be tax-free.
And multimillionaires?
We should pay more to fund your tax cut. Go to first45taxfree.com to learn more. A working-class tax cut paid for by millionaires. That's an idea we can all agree on.
Is getting vaccinated on your to-do list? We can help you check that off.
You've got this.
Yes, you do. See how we've got you at yougotthis.usaging.org. A message from the Aging and Disability Vaccination Collaborative, powered by U.S. Aging.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel, and this is Amicus on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Once again, my thanks to you for spending a portion of your weekend in communication, in discussion, in consideration with me of these major issues in the areas of rule of law, the administration of justice, and government in 2025. In the past and in the future as well, we're beginning our broadcast this weekend by returning to a major story begun last week. That was with the charging of James Comey, the former FBI director. A little bit of review of that, a two-count, fairly sparse, and keep that in mind, a sparse, almost skeletal indictment against him in the Alexandria Division of the Eastern District of Virginia, alleging that on or about September 30th of 2020, that is a time when James Comey, he is at home in Eastern Virginia, which is the reason why the case is brought there. But he is testifying to a Senate committee across the river, across the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. He's talking to a United States senator from that particular committee. Probably that's Ted Cruz in Texas. And the allegation in the first count of the indictment is that during that Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, James Comey, who's the defendant in this case, said that he had not authorized someone else at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports regarding an FBI investigation concerning person one. That's how the indictment reads. And yes, that is cryptic. That is not clear. And we'll get back to the likely attack on that by defense counsel, by James Comey in the future. The upshot is, and people reading between the lines say that this is about Jim Comey telling the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time that he had not, in fact, authorized anybody, probably a fellow named Andrew McCabe. You recall him second in command for a long period of time during the Comey term in office, had not authorized him to reach out to media and tell them something about an investigation, maybe, possibly involving the investigation involving Hillary Clinton. A lot to read between the lines there. That first count alleging that he made a false statement. A second count is based upon the same basic facts, that by virtue of saying those things, that thing that is not true, that he knew about it, he was under oath, it was a false statement, and it was somehow material to the proceeding itself. Second count alleges obstruction of that congressional proceeding. Those are the two charges, and pursuant to the regular practice in America, we have proceedings called arraignments. You know what those are. This is the time when the defendant makes a first appearance officially in court, and indeed, James Comey did just that with his attorney, a very well-known attorney. And we'll talk about him as well in just a moment or so. He appeared this past week in front of Judge Michael Nachmanoff, N-A-C-H-M-A-N-O-F-F. He is a district court. He's a federal trial court judge there in the Alexandria Division of the Eastern District of Virginia. And the purpose, again, once again, of the arraignment is to determine what the defendant's posture in all this is. And it is significant to go through somewhat in detail what happened during this relatively brief, about 30-minute hearing in front of Judge Nachmanoff just this past week. Prosecutors, of course, presenting this indictment, reading the charges out loud, just as I have summarized them here. And in the end, James Comey, through his attorney, pleading not guilty to both of those counts. The attorney himself, we know him well. I know him well from a time that I served as an interim U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Pat Fitzgerald, who used to serve as the United States attorney in the Northern District of Illinois. He is now representing the FBI director, James Comey. And Pat Fitzgerald, of course, is very accomplished as a prosecutor and also as a litigator in general. Recall well that while Pat Fitzgerald was the U.S. attorney there in Northern Illinois, he undertook a number of major, major prosecutions involving terrorism, corruption cases. You may recall he worked on an Al-Qaeda case in New York in the 1990s and then became the U.S. attorney in Chicago, successfully prosecuting some governors there. Their names are George Ryan, Rod Blagojevich, very, very notably. Corruption cases there. Pat Fitzgerald knows what he's doing. He is now representing Jim Comey in this prosecution. And so Pat Fitzgerald stands up and on behalf of his client, James Comey, enters a plea of not guilty to both counts in the indictment. Arguably, however, again, that's not surprising. Arguably, however, the most important thing that comes out of that hearing is the conversation that happens between and among the attorneys and the judge after that. In what is maybe the most significant event and development exchange, Pat Fitzgerald says he intends to file a couple of motions to dismiss the case before trial. And yes, not surprisingly, they're exactly what we chatted about last week on this very broadcast. There is nothing surprising about the legitimate and appropriate reaction to this. Pat Fitzgerald says the first motion that he is going to file is going to be accusing the government of malicious or vindictive or selective prosecution based on what? You know what that's all about. We talked about this at great length. The president's own very public demand of his attorney general, his public insistence that James Comey be prosecuted. And the record of that is clear. We reviewed that in great length. That will, in fact, be the predicate, The very words coming from the President of the United States of America, directing his attorney general to file this lawsuit, to bring this indictment through the U.S. attorney in Eastern Virginia, through the grand jury process, directing that, all of those statements, celebrating afterwards the indictment with an exclamation about that. All of that is going to be a part of Pat Fitzgerald's presentation to dismiss this case upon vindictive prosecution, selective prosecution grounds. And secondarily, he's also going to challenge the appointment of Lindsay Halligan, the second interim U.S. attorney in Eastern Virginia, the woman, the attorney there who brought this case on behalf of the government of the United States of America. When we come back, I'll tell you more about those likely motions, what the Comey defense team said about them, what the judge said in response, and what we can expect in the future coming out of this prosecution as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
107.5 WLAK, Amory's real news and great conversation, and home to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. No one reported in custody or any suspected gunman or gunmen identified after at least four people were killed, more than 20 others injured, in a mass shooting at a bar near Hilton Head, South Carolina, late last night. In Chicago, many were running through the streets because it was the annual Chicago Marathon. Jacob Kiplimo of Uganda and Ethiopian Hawi Faiza won the men's and women's races. Illinois Governor Pritzker should suffer some consequences as Vice President Vance, alleging the governor hasn't protected Illinois citizens. Pritzker says, come and get me. President Trump travels soon to the Mideast, scheduled at what the White House is calling a peace summit in Egypt with leaders of more than 20 countries. From Prime Minister Netanyahu's office, a big day tomorrow.
The release of our hostages will begin early Monday morning. We are expecting all 20 of our living hostages to be released together at one time to the Red Cross.
This is ABC News.
The Brewers beat the Cubs. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from AmFam Field, where the Brewers beat the Cubs 3-1 last night to advance to the National League Championship Series. Things got started for the crew in the bottom of the first with William Contreras at the plate, coverage on TBS.
He pulls this one deep to left center, way back, and gone! The Brewers strike first in Game 5.
Solo home runs later from Andrew Vaughn and Bryce Turang. Jacob Mizorowski, the Miz, awarded the win. Brewers manager Pat Murphy.
Yeah, that Miz was gassed. I would have loved to keep him in. You know, we told him to empty the tank in that last inning. He was magnificent. He who's had some bumps in the road here during his first year for him to come back again in this same series and pitch so well.
So the Brewers host the Dodgers here tomorrow night. First pitch 7:08 for Game 1 of the National League Championship Series. In Milwaukee with sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabe. Normally, I prefer to see movies in the theater, but we'll have to rethink that when Minecraft 2 comes out. Variety reports a Minecraft sequel is in the works after the first flick made almost $1 billion worldwide. Not sure if you remember or heard this, but there is a zombie chicken baby scene that made teenage boys do very gross things in the movie theater. You might want to sit that one out and wait for it to stream. Minecraft 2 is scheduled to hit theaters July 23rd of 2027. Variety is also reporting that Bradley Cooper is in talks to star in the prequel of the Ocean's 11 franchise. The film will be set before the first Steven Soderbergh version of Ocean's 11 in 2001. This franchise is a remake of the original Ocean's 11 from 1960 that starred Frank Sinatra and some of his Rat Pack pals. The new film is rumored to be set in 1960s Europe. Margot Robbie is already on board to play the female lead. They are really milking this ocean thing. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
107.5 WLAK, Amory's real news and great conversation.
And home to Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings from 9 to 11.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy and breezy with isolated showers possible today and a high near 70. Mostly cloudy, still breezy tonight, occasional showers around, and a low in the low 50s. Sunshine returns for Monday, highs in the low 60s. Right now it's 61.
Hey everybody, Todd Allball here. Did you know Packer Love is international? Join us Wednesday from the Marcus Theater in Waukesha for the world premiere of No Packers, No Life, the story of Japanese Packers fans.
There's a Wisconsin story about our state, our team, who we are, and then there's a universal story about people from all over coming together, regardless of culture, distance, language barrier, and finding amazing community over something completely unexpected.
Join us Wednesday, 2 to 4 for the Todd Allball Show.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
State Senator Jeff Smith. We're talking about the Veteran Housing and Recovery Program. Republicans blocked funding for this.
They instead sent the governor a 16-page letter blaming him for this problem. Well, it was in his budget. Once the budget is out of his office and in their hands, it's up to them. Our job is to manage the funding. We can do it, but the governor can't. So it's avoiding our own responsibility by not addressing that.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight from HBO's Task, I welcome Jamie McShane and comedian and host of the WGN Morning Show, Mike Toomey. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are back talking once again about these very significant charges against James Comey. More recently, more charges against Letitia James, the prosecutor, the principal prosecutor in the state of New York. She is the attorney general of that state, also indicted just this past week. James Comey appearing in front of a federal district court judge in Eastern Virginia just this past week, and his attorney describing what the plan is. Not surprisingly, identifying this notion of vindictive prosecution, selective prosecution, animus in the prosecution, and raising that as a threshold matter even before you get to trial. And that's what Pat Fitzgerald was advocating for. Judge, give me a chance to file that motion. As a practical matter, defense counsel, prosecutors, judges, lawyers across the board know that vindictive prosecution, selective prosecution, charges and allegations and defenses are very difficult to show, especially if there is some underlying predicate, some genuine predicate, aside from the animus that may have prompted the prosecution itself. Here, however, this has got real legs. This has got a strong possibility of not only attracting the legitimate attention and focus of the district court, but also arguably an order to dismiss this case based upon basically government misconduct. And how is it predicated? Don't have to do a lot of discovery. Don't have to do a lot of exploration here. You simply need to plumb the media for the past decade or so and find all of those statements in which the president of the United States of America called for James Comey to be prosecuted for various reasons not related to things of substance, but because of political animosities between the two of them. And describing James Comey, among others, as being guilty as hell, celebrating the fact that he was, in fact, indicted in the end. That very revelatory statement made by the president, maybe intended not for public consumption, but it went into the public domain, bemoaning the fact that Pam Bondi, nobody is indicting my political enemies, the president said. And sure enough, days after that, the president finds someone who does just that in the person of Lindsey Halligan, the interim U.S. attorney. Significant also in that defense motion forthcoming is the fact that you've got prosecutors. You've got a litmus test already. Prosecutors appointed by this administration inside the Department of Justice, inside the U.S. attorneys who looked at all this for a couple of months and said there's no there. There's nothing to prosecute. That's a part of the public record as well. That will also be a part of this motion. That will say in the end that because legitimate investigation and completed investigation show that there was no there, the only reason for going ahead then is this animus, and that's vindictive prosecution. That's the argument that Pat Fitzgerald will be making. It is a compelling one. We don't know how the district court judge will resolve it. They're not easy arguments to make. They're most often not successful. But in this case, It will be presented from the words of the President of the United States of America, who fascinatingly, perhaps unknowingly, although someone certainly must have told him, that by making these statements in the public domain, you're undermining the very prosecution that you want to have happen. You are your worst enemy in this case by saying these things about the reason for the prosecution. They're going to be cited verse, chapter, word specific in that motion to dismiss for vindictive prosecution. There's another portion of this defense we also heard about, and that is that the defendant, James Comey, is going to be challenging the capacity of the U.S. attorney who did ultimately sent there into Eastern Virginia to indict this case in front of a grand jury. He's going to be challenging the legitimacy of hers to go ahead and do this. Her name, once again, Lindsay Halligan. She's another interim United States attorney. The defense maintaining that her position there was invalid at the time of the return of the grand jury indictment. You recall well that she presented this to the grand jury, signed off on the indictment. Plainly, perhaps the only person in the office who was willing to do just that. The issue here is that when there's a vacancy in this position, the attorney general is normally able to install someone as an interim U.S. attorney. And yes, indeed, I was one of those in the distant past. That lasts for 120 days. But after that expires, the law also says that a federal court can decide who next serves as that interim. In my situation, once that expired, a federal court judge in eastern Wisconsin appointed me in that position. And so this is an unusual process. Yes, it's very wonky. It's very much in the weeds, I know. But it's important to understand because the U.S. attorney in this case, again, his name is Eric Siebert, was removed for refusing to bring that case against James Comey in the first place based upon no evidence. So what happens is Eric Siebert is gone, and the president immediately appoints a second interim U.S. attorney. The problem is that Eric Siebert had already served a 120-day term as an attorney general appointee. And that term has expired. And the question, therefore, is whether the Trump administration had the authority to make a second interim appointment rather than have that go to the courts. That's going to be charged and that's going to be alleged and argued in context, not of the substance of the indictment, but whether or not the attorney herself, the U.S. attorney herself, had the capacity, the power to serve in that capacity when she did these kinds of things. And then there's this third aspect, which we've also more than hinted at, and that is, what does all this mean in the indictment? Going back to that language that I cited initially, one of the most significant things that Pat Fitzgerald says along the way is that we still have not been told, he said, who person three and person one are. He's making reference to this cryptic language in count one of the indictment. He said, referring to that charging language, he went on to say, we still haven't been told precisely what is in count one or count two. He's scratching his head. Maybe he's going to ask for what's called a bill of particulars. And he goes on to say that with respect to that issue as well, we need to be told what we're being charged with. That, of course, is a fundamental right under our Constitution. That's basically criminal constitutional procedure. And on all three of those bases, there's going to be motions to dismiss this indictment. Each one of them has a merit. These are not frivolous motions, and any one of them could be seized upon by the federal district court judge. They could all be denied. They could all be granted or some variation in between. Along with this description of what the case is likely going to be looking like in the future, engagement by the judge with the attorneys, prosecutors talking about the setting of a trial date. Prosecutors saying, interestingly, that they suddenly had a large amount of discovery, which also includes classified information. That's what the prosecutors told the judge this past week. The judge, looking at that, said, huh? He says, I'm a little skeptical about these insinuations that this case was complex enough to require some extra time, suggesting, what about this statement requires the disclosure of classified information? He says it's fairly limited, fairly skeletal. And indeed, all the attorneys agree that this case can be tried maybe in as little as 2 to 3 days. The question is, when does that happen? And the judge says, this does not appear to me to be an overly complicated case, But I'm not going to force you to go to trial in December if both sides don't feel they can be ready. There's a Speedy Trial Act that contemplates the defendant be ready to go to trial or be permitted to go to trial under his or her rights or its rights within 70 days of the return of the grand jury indictment. And Fitzgerald, Pat Fitzgerald, also said, yes, I'd like that time, but I want to use that time to file these motions. He said, frankly, we feel in this case the cart may have been put before the horse. We'd like certain dispositive motions, and yes, those are the three: vindictive prosecutions, incapacity of the U.S. attorney to file the case in the first place, and lack of particularity about what this case is all about. He said, we'd like certain dispositive motions addressed first in the hopes that a trial can be avoided. And we know beyond that that James Comey and his attorneys have also said, beyond that, you deny all this. Yes, we'd like to go to trial promptly. We'd like to invoke the rocket docket there in Eastern Virginia. Let's get to trial. The judge discussing with the attorneys various dates, proposing sometimes under the Speedy Trial Act going to trial no later than December 17th. The judge says, I'll grant that. Well, let's go ahead. Let's get this case tried. The attorney is proposing some extended time for these motions, and the judge pushing the trial date up a week to about January 5th, and they all agreed to that. Initially, he had set some other dates for that. It appears right now that on the docket, this case is going to trial again in fairly near future. January 5th is the date that the judge set for the trial of this case. That, of course, assumes that these motions will be disposed of. That assumes that all of the motions will be denied and that the case will, in fact, be set to trial, a 2 to 3 day trial sometime in January. If none of those motions articulated by defense counsel Pat Fitzgerald at the arraignment of this past week, if none of those goes ahead, none of those acted on favorably from the defense perspective between now and then we're going to get a trial, arguably, in January. The defendant asking for that. The prosecutor is saying, well, we've got a lot of complex classified information related to this false statement case. Curious to say that again. What do they have to show? They've got to show, of course, the statement was made under oath, that it was false, which, of course, James Comey has denied. He's going to say, no, I never told anybody, never authorized anybody to speak to the media or some other anonymous source about some investigation. He will deny that. Interestingly, to think about the ways in which the government will need to prove that that statement was false, it's got to be knowing that James Comey knowingly made that. And it's got to be material. It's got to make a difference somehow with respect to something in government itself, that progress of this particular proceeding in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's got to be material, got to make a difference of some kind. It's got to matter. That's why these false statement cases, they can be shown, they can be proven, but you need a false statement that's fairly clear and dispositive. Things like the sun rises in the west when in fact it rises in the east. This is not that, and it prompts an awful lot of people to say that putting aside all the motions to dismiss, the merits of the case are not strong, and that even if James Comey does go to trial in January, highly likely that a jury will fail to find beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously, 12 jurors in the federal system there in Eastern Virginia, finding that he knowingly made a false statement under oath, that it was material, it affected the proceeding in some way. That's a heavy burden under this very cryptic allegation against him in count one and also in count two. We will continue to monitor all of that, even as the government, again, through the same office, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern Virginia this past week, added another name to the list of defendants, also the president's adversaries, who are now the subject of a federal indictment. You know what this case is all about. We know that the attorney general of the state of New York, her name is Letitia James, she is charged now by a federal grand jury, same district, although for different reasons, a venue placement, a place of this in Eastern Virginia, not because of any false statement that she made, but because of her possession or ownership of some property there in Eastern Virginia, not in Washington, D.C., not in New York City where she lives, but based upon the location of a piece of real estate. It's a two-count indictment, just like the Comey indictment, but very different charges. announced on Thursday by the U.S. attorney once again, arguably raising the prospect that this U.S. attorney does not have the capacity to go ahead and charge anyone because of this interim appointment that arguably expired. It charges Letitia James with falsely identifying a Virginia rental property that she has as a residence, that she owns that, she resides there, rather than an investment property. And allegedly, she did that to obtain some favorable loan terms. That's the bank fraud nature of the counts against her. She, of course, has denied that. As Amicus Law Review continues, I'll tell you more about her likely defenses and other matters related to this new federal indictment against Letitia James, a sitting attorney general of the state of New York. All that coming up on this broadcast.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In recent weeks, the level of activity from Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has increased quite a bit. There was a raid in Manitowoc at a Walmart parking lot where dairy workers were known to congregate, a series of arrests in Madison, and in Milwaukee, ICE is looking to expand its operations significantly by seeking office space downtown to go along with a new field office on the city's northwest side. This has been concerning for many, and not without reason. A recent large-scale ICE raid in an apartment building in Chicago saw reports of armed federal agents breaking down doors, U.S. citizens detained for hours on end, and children being dragged from their homes in the middle of the night. While the American immigration system has a host of problems, this kind of violent show of force is not an acceptable way to address these problems. And ICE also just received an injection of $45 billion in the One Big Beautiful Bill, so it is imperative for all of us to hold ICE accountable and speak out when things go too far. Right now, things are going way too far.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
Are National Guard troops generally trained in law enforcement? No. National Guard troops like those President Donald Trump deployed to American cities in recent months to crack down on crime are not generally trained in law enforcement. For example, police officers in Washington, D.C. receive 21 training modules in criminal procedure, but Guard members receive none. Their primary training is focused on crowd control. Milwaukee's police union president suggested troops should be sent to Wisconsin's largest city. Governor Tony Evers called National Guard troops the, quote, wrong people, unquote, for fighting crime. I'm Trisha Young for Wisconsin Watch. Fact briefs are bite-sized fact checks of trending claims produced by Wisconsin Watch and GigaFact. Read more at wisconsinwatch.org.
Hey there, Wisconsin. Tom Hartman here. Democracy is not a spectator sport, so join me each and every weekday right here on Civic Media for the Tom Hartman program from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Covering the news of the day and sharing ways for you to get off the sidelines and get active in your community, because change starts with you. Get involved and tune in to the Tom Hartman program Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. right here on your local Civic Media radio station.
Ahoo, this is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review. We're spending this first hour of our weekend broadcast talking all about these indictments of the president's political adversaries, as he has described them himself. Letitia James, the second on this list of people, in that category, now charged by a federal grand jury in Eastern Virginia. Different than the Comey indictment, different charges, specifically a 5-page indictment of her, accusing her of having said in a loan document that she would use a home of hers in Norfolk, Virginia, that she bought in 2020 as a secondary residence to obtain favorable loan terms that could save her about $18,933. Prosecutors are saying that she violated the loan agreement by renting out the home, thus the false statement in that bank document. One count accuses Letitia James of seeking to defraud two financial institutions. The other accuses her of making those false statements. Needless to say, she has denied all of this. Her attorney, named Abby Lowell, has said that Letitia James not only denies the accusations, but in initial statements has indicated that she is going to go down the same road that James Comey has gone down with respect to this likely defense of vindictive prosecution. Indeed, we know well that the president and Letitia James have sparred, not only in court, but beyond that. The case against him brought by Letitia James, in which this $500 million judgment was obtained, it's a civil judgment, to be clear. The trial judge's findings in that case with respect to fraud and valuations of property was upheld, but the amount of money was rescinded, was revoked, basically. The appeal on all of that continues, but along the way, the president has repeatedly been lashing out at Letitia James. And Letitia James, frankly, has been responding also in the public domain, talking about the legitimacy of the things that she has been doing. Interestingly, this case is a bit of a surprise based upon where it came from, what the initial genesis of this case was all about. We know that it came initially from some allegations that were derived from statements made by other government officials having to do with some belief that the documents here were fraudulent, came specifically from a fellow named Bill Pulte, P-U-L-T-E. He was the head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency. He sent a criminal referral to the Justice Department related to homes, residences that Letitia James bought in Norfolk, Virginia in 2023 and in New York City, which is her principal location decades ago. The house the indictment focuses on was not, in fact, included in that initial referral from the Federal Housing Finance Agency, Bill Pulte. It was not that house. That house, also in Norfolk, Virginia, was purchased in 2020. And although that's, again, very much in the weeds, it may also be the subject of some description and some exposition inside the motions to dismiss. It is simply an interesting, albeit small, wrinkle that this is not the house. This is not the residence that was going to be anticipated to be the focus of the indictment. It's different. And it suggests once again that there has been investigation of this. And once again, it raises issues about the legitimacy of the investigation based upon the many, many things that the president has said about Letitia James, and including that she is on a get Trump agenda. Many, many other things out there that he has said over time. And once again, how does that motion for a vindictive prosecution write itself? All you need to do is to pull together, to bring together all of those statements made by the president in the past, over many years, and recently, directing his attorney general, directing the U.S. Attorney's Office in Eastern Virginia, bemoaning the fact that they have not yet indicted these people and then being celebratory when, in fact, they have been indicted. All of those things, can they be included in a motion to dismiss? Absolutely. The mere fact the president says them in the public domain doesn't somehow shield them from presentation inside the court. And you can anticipate that Abby Lowell, who is once again Letitia James' attorney, is going to be culling the news reports if she hasn't already. And that is Letitia James going through all of that and finding all of those and presenting those to the judge as an indication that this is a product of animus. This is the vindictive prosecution, the selective prosecution that is prohibited. And it does, in fact, reflect upon an inappropriate motive. There may, in fact, be some substance here. We don't know. We don't know yet. That's for a trial jury to determine. But as a threshold matter, even before you get to that, if indeed you can show, as the counsel can probably do, at least a prima facie, a superficial showing, that indeed this is, at least in part, the product of animus toward the defendant, that's an improper motive. Not only does it reflect upon the fact that there has been a complete diminution, a destruction of the wall between the Department of Justice and the White House, that's long gone as of 7-8 months ago, that has characterized all other administrations. That's long gone. Now you've got the president telling your attorney general, telling U.S. attorneys who to indict because he doesn't like them. That's the basis for this motion. Likely a motion, again, premised upon the authority of the U.S. attorney there to do this in the first place, based upon her subsequent interim appointment. All of that coming up. And although the indictment here is a bit more fleshed out than is the Comey indictment, could also be the subject of requests for more information. We know that the defense attorneys, as they are appropriately under our Constitution, they are entitled to, defendants are entitled to all the information the government has. That will be forthcoming in this case as well. In our second hour, we're going to comment on a bit more, and that is the reporting out there that John Bolton may be next on the list, what that purports for the rule of law in America. And we'll talk about why that case might be substantively different from the Comey and Letitia James cases, but even in its difference may underscore this notion that this administration is pursuing political enemies of the president upon his direction. That, as we undertake further exposition of these prosecutions here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Another two people injured in one of the mass shootings in Mississippi after high school football games Friday have died in Leland. It makes six people dead. No arrests reported after at least four people were killed, more than 20 others injured in a mass shooting at a bar near Hilton Head, South Carolina last night. President Trump travels soon to the Mideast. He's scheduled at what the White House calls a peace summit in Egypt with leaders of more than 20 countries. On the Gaza ceasefire terms, Monday morning Eastern Time is when Hamas is supposed to release all 20 of the living hostages to the Red Cross. In a speech to the nation, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, "This is a historic event that is tinged with sadness over the release of murderers and joy over the return of kidnapped people." Israel is supposed to release about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. A large majority are from Gaza and were held without charges. This is ABC News. China will